I think sometimes with monasticism, people think of that as an isolating thing, but Benedict especially, he's all about hospitality. And yes, there are lots of focuses also on prayer, on silence, on, you know, the study you do on your own time, but only to the capacity that it enables you to have better community and better hospitality for the stranger.
The Living Church. Serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. When I was in my 20s and figuring out this little thing called life, there is a conversation I remember having with several women friends over a cup of tea or a bowl of soup or curry. We'd be discussing our struggles with vocation. And at some point, one of us would say, you know what, if none of these other things works out, I'm just going to become a nun. So I bought a card for one of my friends with nuns on the front, and I kept it for years to give to her either at her profession or her wedding. She started discernment for the convent in 2019, and I'll tell you at the end of this episode what happened with that. Whether or not we would actually have made good nuns, what all of us were trying to articulate, I think, was the intensity of a desire not just to be Christians, but in a way that was structured and blessed by the church. A calling to holy orders might have done it, but what if we weren't called to that? We wanted to be close to Jesus in certain disciplines, to be accountable. We wanted to live our Christianity with rock and roll horns, and to have a discipleship continuity with Christians past and present. Now, most Christians will not be part of a formal, professed community of other believers set apart to share discipline, prayer, and service, unless you just call that a parish, but that's another podcast episode. So what about those who have taken the habit? How do they live their vocations from the monastery into the world around them? And what about the rest of us? What can we learn, whether lay or ordained, from the disciplines and wisdom of monastics? How do we adapt the intensity of a professed life to our own varied lives in the world? Well, today have I got a treat for you. We are going to hear from three Anglicans whose vocations have been shaped by Benedictine monasticism in different ways. Their stories certainly don't exhaust the options, but I hope that it'll give you some ideas, either as a leader for parish or clergy formation, or for your own walk with Jesus. Now, first, let me just briefly sketch the two Anglican monastic orders that exist. There's Franciscan and there's Benedictine. We're not going to talk about the Franciscans today, but I just want to describe them. They take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They follow the ethos of St. Francis of Assisi. They're usually known for their poverty and practical works of mercy. You will not find a Franciscan with their nose stuck in a book, typically. They have got things to do, places to be for the kingdom. In fact, I was not able to get a Franciscan on the podcast, which is why we're only doing Benedictines today. Then you have the Benedictines. They take vows of stability, obedience, and conversion of life. They are the bookworms of the monastics. They are known for study and Lectio Divina. But as we'll hear today, meditation on God's word, silence, contemplation, can lead into all kinds of radical callings. Benedictines also form and follow a plan for pursuing their daily conversion called a rule of life, typically based on a book called The Rule of St. Benedict, 6th century guidelines for life in monastic community. Now, among monastics, there are first order monastics. These are usually in monasteries. We'll hear about those today. And then we'll also hear about third order monastics or oblates. Those aren't the same thing exactly, but they're similar. They often don't have the same vows, or at least they aren't as strict as first order monastics. I don't know where the second order monastics went. Maybe somebody can tell me. I'll introduce our guests as we go. Our first guest is Sister Greta Roningen. Sister Greta is co-founder of Community of Divine Love. This is an Episcopal monastery in the Benedictine tradition, located in San Gabriel, California. She is also an Episcopal priest, a prison chaplain, and author of Free on the Inside, Finding God Behind Bars. I really enjoyed my conversation with her. She's a fascinating woman, and I think you will too. Now, whether you're into wimples, cinctures, and Birkenstocks, or following Jesus without the telltale garments, here's to holy habits of all kinds. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Sister Greta, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Could you tell me just a bit about your own role in the monastic life and how you came to this really unique place?
Going back to 2004, which is when it really started, I was spending a lot of time at the Society of St. John the Evangelist in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And if I was a different gender, I would have joined them. It was so meaningful to me. But in 2008, I was already sort of living like a nun. I had gotten rid of my belongings. I was praying the offices on my own. It was a great time of great change and transformation for me. And I felt a deep call to be a chaplain. My priest at the time, who was at All Saints Beverly Hills, he gave me the connection to the man who was running a chaplaincy program in the hospital in Los Angeles. And he was brilliant. And I immediately found myself sitting at that table and going through the training. But at the same time, he also said, come on Thursday and there's going to be a prison chaplain speaking to our church. And that was Brother Dennis. But Dennis
oh,
Gibbs.
Yeah. Okay. So he's also at the monastery that you're at. Okay.
Yes. Dennis spoke about what he was doing in the LA County jails, and it was very moving and touching. And we instantly became great, great friends. He was also in the CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education Program, that I was in because he was on the ordination track to be a deacon in the church. And he invited me to do some of my clinical hours in the jails, and I was allowed to do that. And I really had no idea that I would be equipped in any way to be, I don't know, an appropriate person to be in that environment. But very quickly, I fell deeply in love with chaplaincy in the jails. And so we went to visit my spiritual father, a beautiful monk at SSJE, named Brother Eldridge Pendleton, who's passed away now, but one of the most beautiful human beings I've ever met. And I wanted Dennis to meet him and to see the monastery there. And while we were there, we discerned that maybe we were called to start our own community, grounded in the work with the incarcerated. We were encouraged by these two communities, and by our bishop, who was at that time Bishop John Bruno, and the Order of Holy Cross agreed to mentor us. So over the years, we worked on our formation and our foundational rule and so on. So we are a little what we call now our house of prayer, because we're really just two. And we have about 17 oblates to our community. And then we have about 22 divine companions, which are men and women in prison who have chosen to be an intentional relationship. They sign an agreement of following the precepts that we have created of a prayerful life, a life of nonviolence, a life, certain vows that they're taken and so on that we establish with them. They write their own rule, and then we work with them to develop that. And then they're received by us during a Eucharist. I'm now an Episcopal priest, as you said. So we have a Eucharist and we receive them, and then we send them the document of their reception. Sadly, we can't send them one of our crosses, which we give to our oblates.
Oh.
Because we're not allowed to send anything like that in, but We send them our books and things like that.
Well, Sister Greta, as you are following your vocation as an Episcopal priest, as a monastic, as someone who works in state penitentiaries, I'd love to hear a little more about what being Benedictine specifically means here. How does this look different because you're a Benedictine as opposed to, say, a Franciscan? What special gifts does this bring into your ministry?
I couldn't do what I do without the prayer life that I live in. It's unusual, Amber, that a Benedictine would be doing the kind of outreach that we do. The groundedness of this life gives me what I need to be able to walk in trauma, which is the world that I walk into. Every step in a prison is sort of saturated with stories of trauma. And that's the work that the program that I run is called Healing Dialogue and Action. And it's listening circles where the men start to really become aware of their own, the environment that they were raised in, the trauma that they were subjected to. So we say hurt people. And if you don't transform the pain, you will transmit the pain. So it's a very deep dive into the past, but also into the harm caused and developing empathy for victims.
Would you say that you have seen that connection there between what you're walking through with them and the contemplative way of life that is Benedictine?
Yes, 100%. And we've integrated not only meditation, but also, you know, Lexio Divina is very much a part of Benedictine tradition. So we immerse ourselves in it, and that I know that comes with me into these environments. When we were in the county jails, our evangelical brothers and sisters were very, very, very aggressively anti-Episcopalian.
Really?
It was very hard. They were very hurtful. They would yell at the women if they saw me with them and say that they were cutting them off. And they told them that I was leading them off the cliff into hell. So it was really disheartening. And it was very aggressive. They yelled at the women in front of me that if they were gay, they were going to hell forever and ever, and they'd never know God. So it was hard. And so now there's an organization called the Urban Ministry Institute that is a evangelical seminary. And they've asked me, a friend of mine asked me to help her facilitate it. And so it's proven to be quite a beautiful experience and quite healing for me, because they're kind and they're loving, this group. And they, you know, I get to sometimes say, well, wait a minute, do you think that maybe Jesus died because he stood up to the domination system? And they're like, yeah, you know, so I'm able to sort of bring some Episcopal theology, a more progressive theology, into this environment. So it's been a beautiful walk for all of us, I think. A deeper appreciation for the beauty of the faith in that expression. When you take out the kind of nastiness, you know, there's a deep faith there.
Yeah.
And a deep love of Jesus that we share.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that part of your story and everything you shared today will be so interesting and encouraging to people. And I just wonder what God will surprise you with next.
Thank you, Amber.
It was the surprises that stood out to me about Sister Greta's story. By following a draw to simplicity and praying the offices, she almost stumbled upon these other gifts: chaplaincy, prison ministry, monastic life, finding God's way of peace in trauma, and seeing Jesus in other Christians despite deep theological divides. Monastics have often been called to surprising or extraordinary work. Now, how might these vows of stability, obedience, and conversion intersect with the daily work of pastoring a parish? I sat down with the Reverend Canon Brian Biba to discuss just that. Brian is assistant rector at Christ Church Anglican in Savannah, Georgia. He's also canon for leadership for the Gulf Atlantic Diocese of the Anglican Church in North America. He is an oblate of the Order of St. Benedict at St. John's Abbey, which is a Roman Catholic monastery in Collegeville, Minnesota. Brian, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's great to chat with you, Amber. So glad to be on.
Yes. And if our listeners didn't know, this is a very important fact. I am godmother to one of Brian's daughters.
Yes. Auntie Amber, very important part of our family.
Very important role. Well, speaking of roles, I would love for you to tell me, Brian, a bit about your own role in the monastic life and how you came to it.
Yeah, sure. In college, I first discovered the kind of contemplative tradition, reading Dallas Willard, Richard Foster, kind of people coming from the evangelical world, discovered this like deep longing to be silent, to be still, to seek union with Christ. Along that journey, you know, Thomas Merton was an important read for me, a lot of his writings, but also then started reading a lot of church fathers, ancient traditions. In graduate school, St. Athanasius' Life of St. Anthony, and also the Rule of St. Benedict. And I remember particularly reading both of those documents and just being struck by the beauty and really drawn into that way of practicing the Christian faith. I knew that God was calling me to be a person who took the contemplative life seriously. And a key moment for me in discerning my call was reading the Pastoral Rule by St. Gregory the Great. And the way he described pastoral ministry and the way he described the contemplative life and the fusion of the two, that basically a pastor is a spiritual director for a local community. There was a lot of people in his day seeking the monastic life and running from parish ministry. And Gregory kind of rightly says, being a monk is easy. Can you be a monk in the world caring for the souls of regular people? And I heard that so clearly, like the voice of the Lord through Gregory to me. And that is what brought me initially to St. John's. I did a retreat there and really found it to be a place of welcome and a place of peace. And I remember speaking to one of the brothers there, and he shared with me just the truth that, like, you really can't care for the souls of your sheep and the souls of your family unless you're caring for your own soul. So I made a commitment to do a regular retreat somewhere, and St. John's became that place for me. And that journey is really what opened up the journey of being an oblate.
So you're an oblate. That means you take vows. You're committed to be part of the St. John's community, and it is a Roman Catholic community. Can you tell me a little bit more about St. John's Abbey, what you love about it, what it means to be a Benedictine?
Yeah. That's a great question. So to be an oblate, it's a vow to live the rule of St. Benedict as much as your life allows it. I have a parish ministry position. I have a family, a wife and kids. So, you know, I can't be as faithful to the rule as someone who is single and cloistered in a monastery. But what it does mean for me is, first, I'm constantly reading the rule. Alongside regular reading of scripture, regular prayer, I'm reading the Rule of St. Benedict and always asking, okay, what does this mean for me? How do I apply this? Great example of that, chapter 52 famously talks about welcoming guests. Benedict says any guest in a monastery has to be welcomed as if they're Christ. That looks a certain way in a monastic community, hosting retreatants and welcoming people in prayer. But in my family life, that looks like, hey, having dinners regularly with people.
Yeah.
That looks like bringing a meal to someone who's having a hard time, which we're actually doing later today, making that extra commitment to hospitality. to your point earlier, yes, I am part of a Roman Catholic Benedictine community, which is not unusual, but it's definitely distinct. Benedictine Christianity preceded, you know, the East-West split. It preceded the Reformation. People forget Benedict was a lay person. It really, at the core, Benedictism is about any ordinary person seeking to follow Jesus in their life together. To be clear, very happy to be Protestant, very proud of the Reformation heritage, very glad to be in the ACNA. But at the same time, I want to embody a faith that goes beyond my particular tradition. St. John's is a very ecumenical environment. I think almost a quarter of the oblates at St. John's are Protestant.
Wow.
So this is just a big part of their life.
How does monastic life, these monastic disciplines, affect or intersect with your ministry?
Personally, I think I was probably about 5 or 6 years into ordained ministry full time that I started to feel what I think a lot of people feel. And that's like my faith and my ministry were kind of becoming synonymous. It comes really difficult to separate like the vocational work of ministry and your own personal devotional life. And part of becoming an oblate for me was anchoring my life, not in my priesthood or in my being a husband or a father or any other thing I do. My fundamental identity is as a disciple of Christ. I really believe that good ministry is always out of the overflow of our own life with God. So in order to avoid burning out, in order to ground my day-to-day work in my discipleship to Jesus, the Benedictine way is a kind of anchor for my soul and my ministry. Benedict says famously in the prologue, prefer nothing to the love of Christ. Programmatically, I lead a retreat here at my church every month. That is kind of a Lectio Divina retreat. It's the kind of thing you would get if you did a retreat at a St. John's. It's like one of the happiest things I do in my ministry. On my class on prayer, St. Benedict's always popping up. I think Benedict's rule has some of the best practical advice on prayer that there is. But again, like the other, like let more hidden stuff, you know, I really try to be intentional about stopping to pray in a way that, again, can feel really rote if you're just keeping the office. Mm-hmm. But, you know, stopping to do those lesser hours, stopping before I, you know, go into a pastoral call in my car. I have a Benedictine breviary that I use in addition to the 2019 prayer book that kind of offers up those other offices. And, you know, I have this accountability. I go every year, I go to St. John's. And every year I see the same brothers that I've gotten to know and have become confessors and friends. And they're good about like, hey, so how's this going?
Wow.
And you're like, oh boy, how is it going?
I guess it's a little bit like standing up with your back against the doorpost, spiritually speaking, and they have a pencil and they're, you know, drawing a line at the top of your head saying, okay, what's happened since last time you stood up against this doorpost? How much have you grown? I mean, that's serious.
That's exactly right. And, you know, like I'm a firm believer, like part of the rule is like obedience. For people who are under authority, you know, we need even more accountability. Maybe because I'm a little crazy, but I'd like to think that it's good for me and it's helping me to do the work God's given me to do.
I've been talking to the Reverend Canon Brian Biba, Assistant Rector at Christ Church Anglican in Savannah. Brian, thanks again so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Amber. Prefer nothing to the love of Christ.
Mic drop. Hello, dear podcast listener. If you don't have plans the first weekend of November, I'd love to invite you to our worship and arts conference, Awe and Presence. It's hosted in a lovely little nook of St. Louis at the Episcopal Church of St. Michael and St. George. And we're going to be asking at this conference how the beauty and the rhythms of worship shape us, body and soul, for life with God. We're going to look at this through the lens of the arts. So topics will range from George Herbert and prayer to worship with sacred images to the bodily senses in worship and more from some incredible speakers, including poet and musician Malcolm Geit, theology and arts guru David Taylor, poetry scholar Abram Van Engen, communicator of all things medieval Grace Hammond, and liturgy scholar Matthew Olver. If you want to learn more about traditional Christian worship and contemporary life through some amazing conversations, join us. Register and get more info at livingchurch.org/events or click the link in today's show notes. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Image Journal. Image Journal is one of the leading journals on contemporary art and faith, featuring full-color visual art and thoughtful pieces from writers such as Rowan Williams, Annie Dillard, Victoria Chang, Bruce Cockburn, Marilyn Nelson, Kathleen Norris, Padraig O'Tooma, and Lauren F. Winner. I know you recognize some of those names. Image grapples with the mystery of being human through exploration of religious faith and spiritual questions. With new editor-in-chief Molly McCulley Brown, an incredible writer in her own right, now is a great time to subscribe. Or you can check out their fall lineup of craft writing classes and film and reading seminars. Learn more about all these things at imagejournal.org. That's imagejournal.org. Prefer nothing to the love of Christ. Wow, what a way to end a call. But even as his friend, over the years, I can tell this formation has affected Brian. It's really shaped his life. He was first drawn to the beauty of monastic life and then discovered it's a lifeline. For Father Brian now, to be a good pastor means being nurtured in Benedictine rhythms and accountability, both for ministry and for his own soul. And, bonus, like with Sister Greta, it's also been a bridge across divides in the church. By the way, if you're interested in the Benedictine breviary for daily prayer that Brian mentioned, I'll include a link to that book in the show notes today. Now, we've heard from a monastic and from a parish priest. Now, how about a regular old lay person? Some of you might actually already know my next guest. With her sister, she's the co-host of the very edifying and very entertaining podcast, The Average Episcopalian. Her name is Annie Hodges. Annie is a supply chain manager by day and a podcaster by night. With her sister, Kate Greer, she hosts The Average Episcopalian, tackling the mystery of faith with reason and humor through the lens of the church they love. Talking with her was a delight, but I was also inspired by the way her parish has been doing radical discipleship, but in a low-key, bookish, Benedictine way. Annie, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, man. Like, I'm a fan of your podcast. You're a fan of my podcast. We'll try not to just go fangirl and leave everybody else in the dust.
Yeah.
Fangirling, but
yeah.
What is your role in the monastic life? How do you touch down there? And how did that happen?
Our church does what's called a Benedictine groups. And I think they started within the past 5 years. So they're still pretty new and they are lay led. So they're not led by our preachers. It used to only happen in the mornings, like, you know, during primetime corporate America. If you have a job at 9 to 5, you can't really
right.
go.
Yes.
But then they started one that was in the evening on Tuesdays. And when they started that one, my friend who had been going to the morning one invited me and my husband. And we just went and we've never looked back.
Did you have any familiarity with any fascination with monasticism before then? Or had you read The Rule of Saint Benedict? I mean, you just went in completely blind and curious.
Yeah, completely blind. I think sometimes, especially me as a cradle Episcopalian, I can roll my eyes at the idea of like, invite your friend to this event. Like, okay, what's that going to do? But it really does speak to us, the power of a simple invitation. It was just one of our friends who was another young adult in the church who really loved it. And she said, you should come and try it.
Can you tell us a little bit about the structure of this? Like what a typical meeting looks like?
It's extremely structured, which is one of the beauties of it, is it's very reliable. every meeting is an hour and they literally ring a bell at the beginning and ring a bell at the end. Like, you know that you're never going to go over. It always starts right on time. So if you are running late, you're usually walking in while we're reading the Psalms already. It's very cozy. We just meet in like one of the small classrooms around the table in the church. We start each time by reading that day's rule. So if you're not familiar with the rule of Saint Benedict, it was a rule that he wrote for his monastery, down to which readings you should read on which day, how you should run the kitchen, lots of different detail in there. But we'll read and reflect on that day's rule. Then we will read Psalms aloud in unison. Typically, we follow the lectionary there. And then also we have a psalm usually that we're working on memorizing. I'm not very good at memorization, so I haven't memorized anything yet. But we move into group Lectio Divina, where we read a passage of scripture and do group reflection on that. Then we move into intercessory prayer and then Lord's Prayer to close out the intercessory prayer. And usually the last 10 to 15 minutes of that hour are spent in basically Benedictine book club, where we talk about whatever book we are reading at the time. So, and then also it's expected that outside of the meeting, you would start practicing your own daily rule of life. I think sometimes with monasticism, people think of that as an isolating thing. I think we have this picture of a monk in our mind where we're like, they go into a cave and they don't talk to anyone. It's all inward work. But Benedict especially, and I can't speak to any of the other monks. I only really know Benedict, but he is all about hospitality. A lot of his tenets are about hospitality.
Yep.
And community. A lot of his rule is written about how to interact with other people in the monastery. And yes, there are lots of focuses also on prayer, on silence, on, you know, the study you do on your own time, but only to the capacity that it enables you to have better community and better hospitality for the stranger. I've only been a part of the group for 2 years, but I truly feel like it's reprogrammed my brain. I work a day job. I work a corporate job. I lead a very busy life. I live in a city. I have big social life. And ideas like talking to God throughout my day, or, you know, praying multiple times throughout my day, like, I'll be the first to say that that seemed like something that was just unachievable for my modern busy lifestyle. And yes, I was engaged to church and I was, you know, reading my Bible, I was doing some stuff. But the way that I think about life, the way I see the world, my ability to like self-regulate, my own self-awareness, the compassion I have. I feel like it's just Benedict's thought process and then the repetitive action of reading Psalms, praying for others, and then studying things like humility, silence, community. Work is a place where we are all challenged to interact with people that perhaps we wouldn't choose to interact with on a social level, or that are maybe grind our gears, you know? I feel like I used to just see that as an inconvenience and annoyance. It's the person that you vent about when you get home. I don't know. I just find myself more accepting of circumstances and of people as they are. One of the quotes from one of the various books we've read, and I don't remember which one, but it talks about offering no resistance to life. Like, don't offer resistance to life, because those people that, you know, push your buttons are going to be there regardless, whether they're in your family, whether they're in your workplace. And so offering resistance doesn't help anything. You're not going to be able to change people. And so I feel like I've definitely, I hope, maybe if you ask my husband, he'd say different, but I've vented about work less. I feel like I know there are still people that grind my gears, but my approach is to just accept that that is who they are. And yeah, this is who this person is. And so how do I learn to interact with them and see the Christ in them?
Yeah, totally. And you know what that reminds me of too, is the, you know, the taking the vow of stability.
Yeah.
That there's an exterior discipline of stability, but then mm-hmm. there's also that interior discipline
stability.
Mm-hmm. Of staying. Because like, if you're a monk and you're like, oh, I don't like my brothers and sisters, I'm gonna go somewhere else. Sorry. You're going to find another version of Frank and another version of Mary Frances, you know, wherever you go. And if you find those patterns, turns out like God's probably trying to teach you something.
Yes.
And might be grinding your gears, slash maybe the iron is sharpening your iron. Maybe it's just annoying, but even then it's an opportunity to at least lean into God, I would guess. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. One of the books we read that is honestly one of my favorite books to recommend to people who maybe are new to Benedictine spirituality and also who might be more tactical like me. I'm an engineer by trade. I work in supply chain. I'm a very tactical person. The book is called Saint Benedict's Toolbox by Jane Tomaine, who's an Episcopal priest in the Northeast. I recommend that book a lot because it's very tactical and it goes through a lot of the principles of Benedictine spirituality. But one of the things she spoke about, because she has a whole chapter on work and also a chapter on hospitality that talk about accepting people. And she points out that, yes, that person that annoys you the most is exposing your limitations. Like, it's a commentary on you and what you're capable of handling, how you're capable of loving, how welcoming you're capable of being. So, yes, if you're in a job long enough, we all have the thought of, like, should I just be working at Lucasfilm Animation Studios and, like, working on Star Wars? Or should I just be, yeah, should I just be a baker? Should I be, like, baking muffins for people instead of, you know, in these spreadsheets?
Should I be Maggie Gyllenhaal from Stranger Than Fiction?
Yeah, we all have those
days. What am I doing with my master's degree anyway?
Uh-huh. And even if you feel directionally like you're in the right place, or that directionally you're in a workplace that's supportive, or you know, you're in a good spot, you have days or weeks where you're like, what am I doing? What is work? Mm-hmm. And the call of stability has also helped me in that way in the workplace, where, yes, of course, there's times where change is required or evolution is required, or you should chase a dream that exists. However, just because I'm uncomfortable in a situation, or maybe I'm tired or I'm low, that doesn't necessarily mean that running away and doing something completely different is the right answer. And so the concept of stability has helped me in the workplace in that way too. I've gotten a little bit better, but there's a long way to go. You know, that's the big thing with faith. And then also with the Benedictine rule, is the reason you have to stick to these disciplines is because it's continuous work. It'll never end.
I mean, you guys can't see this right now because I'm on camera with Annie, but her face is glowing whiter than a Fuller could bleach it, and she is levitating. So she definitely is.
I'm done. I'm finished.
Take her now, yeah. Lord, in the chariot of fire.
There's a long way to go, but yeah, I've seen small fruits. And hopefully those around me, that's what matters more, is that those around me have hopefully seen it too.
I've been speaking today with Annie Hodges, who is a supply chain manager by day. She podcasts with her sister, Kate, and they host together the Average Episcopalian podcast. Annie, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a delight. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Benedictine disciplines of obedience, stability, and a rule of life make room for the grace of conversion. And I love that a sign of that in Annie's life is how often or not she gets cranky with her coworkers. So practical, very fitting for an engineer. If you're interested in the very practical book she talks about, St. Benedict's Toolbox, you can look in the show notes for a link. I hope you've enjoyed our monkish Anglican adventures today with St. Benedict. Whether you're into the Benedictine rule, way, or option, or more into St. Francis's less structured way of sanctity, or if you're new to this treasure box of discipleship and curious for more, I hope something encouraging, challenging, or creative makes its way to your monastery, the place where you are alone with God, and from which you're being called to serve others. Oh, yeah, and my friend who was in discernment to become a nun, well, I finally mailed the card to her and her new husband last year. She is not a nun, but they are living as faithful Catholics in Minnesota. Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. Our Liturgy and Arts Conference Awe and Presence is coming up in November. We'd love to have you. Learn more and buy tickets at livingchurch.org/events. In 2 weeks, who are the Moravians? We'll put another stamp in our communion partner passports by chatting with Moravian pastors Derek French and Blair Couch to talk about their rich tradition, their fascinating history with ecumenical work. It goes way, way back. They're like the original gangsters of ecumenical work, and what we can learn from our Moravian brothers and sisters today. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.